This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. Access a vast selection of global fixed income securities at Interactive Brokers Bond Marketplace. Search their deep availability of over 1 million bonds globally and use IBKR's bond search tool to compare available yields against those of other brokers. Interactive Brokers has no markups or built-in spreads and low, fully transparent commissions on bonds. IBKR displays the highest bids and lowest offers received from the electronic venues that they access. In addition, clients can interact with each other by placing bids and offers online to execute their trades. Learn why Benzinger rated Interactive Brokers their best online broker for bonds for two consecutive years. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC. Visit ibkr.com/bonds.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
It's the end of May. Two-thirds of the quarter is over. Waiting for the split as shares rocket higher. NVIDIA, of course. Looking for reasons to be bearish or bullish. And our guest today, Ross Gerber of Gerber Kawasaki. All this and much more on episode number 871 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And welcome to the start of 2024. I'm Andrew Horowitz, and I'm happy to be sharing this time with you. Thanks for joining me this week and every week on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Also, of course, the DH Unplugged, Dvorak Horowitz. We get together, myself and John C. Dvorak, every Tuesday. We talk, I don't know, all sorts of things, fun things. I want to consider it the lighter side of finance, the DH Unplugged podcast, and it gets a lot of great reviews, so thank you for that. If you haven't listened, if you haven't been a part of that, I highly encourage you to make sure to find from any podcast app that's out there. Just search in DH Unplugged, and you'll find what that's all about. We play some great games, do some fun things. Well, we've had some wild swings in the markets. I don't think that's totally unexpected. I don't think you're surprised by it. I'm not. We've been talking to clients for the last month and a half, that we're expecting that as we get through earnings season, as we get towards the end, a lot of things that are out there that are going to be kind of concerning. I mean, we saw the VIX plummet recently, which is often a sign that investors have gotten a little bit too comfortable. Sometimes you hear it being called complacent. And it's the same thing when the VIX spikes, right? When people get very nervous and they're really so concerned that they just start capitulating and selling. And that's when we see the VIX and the volatility gauge go sky high. But when we see it either side peak out, it's often a sign for something is brewing. We're going to have a lot to talk about, good things to talk about with our guest. I'm really excited about bringing Ross back today. But I want to get you into a discussion that I'm pretty sure that we haven't talked about ever on the show. Because it's something that maybe not everybody is inclined to think about. It's much more exciting to talk about stocks than it is to talk about, oh my God, here we go, bonds. And yes, is it a boring topic? This idea, well, not really. It used to be a little bit more boring, but the opportunity now to do things like laddering bonds and utilizing cash as a buffer alternative, pretty interesting. And maybe very timely that we talk about this also. But I think there's some ways that we could talk about making money on those excess funds that are just sitting around and actually making some good money on them. I mean, if you want to be simple and you want to do it very practically, you could just find some of the mutual funds, money markets, or money markets that are paying 4 to 5% maybe. And that's a way to do it, especially if you have small sums of money that you want to put aside. And I got to tell you something, I would encourage you highly. If you have checking accounts with assets in them that sit around for a while, but every once in a while you have to use those, you could look for an alternative. If it's $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 that you leave in there as a core, look for these money market mutual funds or even the money markets that are available from major brokers. We know the names that are out there. We talk about them all the time. You can get good money on just idle cash. Now, there's another way to do this also and even make more money. And we've been doing this with clients. And yes, it takes some money. It's not the $10,000 or $15,000 amount. $300,000, $400,000, $1 million. We do this regularly. But if you do have some money sitting around and it's not making much money and you're making like 3.5% with your bank and it is a substantial sum, listen to this. It's called bond laddering. And what we're going to do is do a little bit of a deep dive into this discussion, a little more sophisticated investment strategy in the world of fixed income. And with this, we can help you manage interest rate risks, provide a steady stream of income. And most of all, what we're looking for this kind of money is liquidity. So let's break down what bond laddering is and why, I don't know, maybe it could be a good addition to your investment strategy. So I guess we could look at this as a strategy that involves purchasing a series of bonds with different maturities. So we're going to be looking at 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, 8 month, 9 month, whatever it is. Instead of just investing a lump sum into bonds that all mature at the same time, what you're doing here is you're spreading, which we like to talk about, diversification, right? You're spreading your risk. You're spreading the investment across bonds that mature over staggered intervals. And what this does is creates a ladder. That's what it's called. And a ladder of bonds that mature over a period of time. Think about a ladder with rungs. You can invest on the bottom rung, the 3 month, and another one at the 6 months. And as we go off in time, something matures and you'll have the availability then to reinvest. So imagine you have $100,000, $500,000, $1 million, whatever it is to invest in bonds. So instead of investing, let's say all of that in a 3 month that you get 5% on, we could buy five different total bonds, each with $20,000 in the case of $100,000. And the maturities of 1, 3, 4, and 5 months, years, whatever you want to look at. Right now, we're on the short side. We're looking at somewhere maximum about a year out and something that is going to be maturing continually. Now, what happens here, as each bond matures, you can reinvest the principal and the ultimate interest into a new bond at the end of the ladder, maintaining these staggered maturities that keep on coming up and then all of a sudden rolling them back in. So if you have a $20,000 bond in this $100,000 total investment and you do it in T-bills, well, you're going to buy it at a discount. So in the end, it's going to become $20,000, right? So you're going to buy it at $19,000 and it's going to be $20,000. Well, don't buy just $20,000, buy $21,000 the next time it's discounted back to, let's say, $20,000. Over whatever period it is. There's just examples. So that you're constantly reinvesting as much as possible and you're leaving as little in cash as possible as well. And there's a lot of benefits in this whole bond laddering. You have interest rate risk management, steady income stream, there's liquidity and diversification. So in terms of the interest rate risk and the management of that, because we know that interest rates are going to fluctuate over time. But if we do this properly and have it in such a way that we're not concerned about having long-term illiquid style bonds that are, 20, 30 years out, and we're doing this in a shorter period of time, if you invest all your bonds maturing at the same time, you may have this reinvestment risk. You may have interest rate risk because when you take the money out of all of them, it's going to be whatever is left is what you're going to have to invest in. When we do it with a laddering, you spread the exposure over different interest rate environments. Again, that reduces the impact of interest rate changes on your portfolio. Now, again, with the short-term bonds, the bonds that are 3 month, 4 month, 5 month, 6 month, 9 month, not as much problem from a interest rate risk standpoint, reinvestment risk standpoint, or a liquidity standpoint, right? We want to make sure we have an enhanced liquidity that gives you flexibility to respond to whatever changing financial needs are out there. You also get a steady income stream. So you have these bonds maturing at regular intervals. You're going to receive periodic returns of the principal, but also the interest that is earned on it. So you can either take some out if you need to, if you're retired, or if you just want to roll them. Now, we do this a lot for clients. Over the last couple of years, a lot of clients have said, you know, I have this excess cash. I need this through my retirement. How can we make the most of it? And I want to be able to have some liquidity. I don't have to have, you know, daily liquidity, but I need some. So this diversification within this fixed income, this laddering, is helping do that. So how do you actually do this? So I think the first thing you need to do when we're looking at the bond laddering implementation program is the first thing you need to do is determine, okay, what's my investment time horizon? Put some thought into, okay, what period do we want this to totally extend? What's the final point that we're willing to accept? Common ladders might range from, you know, 1 to 12 months, or even maybe 1 year to 5 years, or even 8 years. Right now, I would suggest not going too long, but the optimal ladder and length of this all depends on your financial needs. When is it going to be that you can wait till the last one to come due? And what we want to do is select bonds with staggered maturities. We could look at, if it's, let's go back to the 1 year. We could say, okay, we're willing to do 2 months for 5 bonds, 2 month, 4 month, 7 month, 9 month, and a year. And then we need to make sure to have a plan that when they come due to reinvest, we talked about that. And you monitor these, you adjust them. You see, okay, at the time that the bond actually matures, okay, great. What is it that I want to do there and what are the rates like? Now, in this environment right now, again, short-term rates, the 3 to 7 month is the sweet spot for yields right now. That may change. That may go longer, may go shorter. So when you get the bond that matures, you look at that, you say, okay, where are we? Probably I want to go to the longer side if things don't change very much. So again, I'm going to go back to my 8 month bond, which it matures and kind of roll things, keep on rolling things right after the last one that we have in my list that I own. And then you just keep on moving it. Now, bond laddering is I would say, a pretty powerful strategy for managing interest rate risk, ensuring the steady income, and again, maintaining liquidity, because you have a liquidity event that happens regularly. The longer you go out, the more bonds you can purchase. You don't need to go crazy with this. But if you have a 5 year period, you could do, let's say, 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year, 5 year, right? You could do it like that. So I hope that kind of helps. But by spreading your investment risk and investments with bonds across different maturities, again, you can create this balanced and I would say resilient fixed income portfolio. Something to think about, something that we do a lot for clients, and something I wanted you to just consider, because we don't talk about that much. Much more exciting to talk about AI and talk about crypto than it is bonds necessarily. But there's a lot of you out there that have pretty significant bond portfolios. And if we can get you 5.3% on a 1 year ladder and keep on rolling that, you know, and of course there's some expense involved in that. But if it gets you net 5.2, 5.1, 5% even, and you're only yielding, let's say, 3.2 in your current bank account or sometimes less, why not do this? Every $100,000 is going to yield you another $5,000, $400 and $420 per month. So there you go. Something to think about. All right, I want to talk about one more point, and I want to bring this to your attention right before we get to our guest, Ross Gerber. I want to talk about Interactive Brokers because, you know, I don't know if you know this, but you don't have to wait for the markets to open at Interactive Brokers. With around-the-clock trading, you could trade over 10,000 U.S.-listed stocks and ETFs. You could also do U.S. equity index options and U.S. Treasury bonds. Around-the-clock trading helps you stay ahead by allowing you to react instantly to market-moving news and capture more market opportunities. The flexibility allows you to trade on your timetable, and invest during local market hours or whenever it's convenient for you. Interactive Brokers is rated a top online broker, winning multiple awards from Barron's, Investopedia, Stockbrokers.com, and many others. Open an Interactive Brokers account today and discover more trading opportunities around the clock, because the best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Learn more at ibkr.com/aroundtheclock. And as I promised, our guest today is Ross Gerber. He's the co-founder and president and CEO of Gerber Kawasaki Wealth and Investment Management. He oversees Gerber Kawasaki Corporate Investment Management Operations, as well as serves individual clients. And he's been, you know, Ross has been a face out there and a voice that you can hear on social media. Traditional media is all over the place. You know, it's not one media that I'm aware of that he's not been on. And he's one of the most influential investment advisors and fintech innovators in America. So how's that? Look at that. Got him on. Unbelievable the talent we get here. Ross,
I like that intro. I like the intro.
How are you doing, man? What's going on out there in California?
Well, you know, California is a wonderful place to live, and we're getting into the best time of year to live in California, which is, you know, spring, summer, fall. Winter's pretty nice here compared to the rest of the country, you know, in general. But boy, you know, this state is really a fun state during the summer.
Yeah, that's fun there. The other stuff is all the crazy stuff in that state, too. I mean, only followed by Florida, man, Florida, you know?
I mean, you know, honestly, it's really just crazy liberalism here versus just total insanity in Florida, you know?
Yeah, that's correct. We got both sides going crazy down here.
Yeah, you know? Totally.
Well, let's talk about markets. Let's talk about things. Let's talk about, I mean, obviously, we got to hit the major areas, the whole AI. We'll talk about maybe indices. I don't know where to go first, but let's start with this to start basic stuff here. Let's just get it out of the way and talk about the Fed and I think the problems that they've created, the bad mistake that they made or a mistake they made back in October, I would say, by spiking the ball on inflation and where we are today. I mean, because, I mean, we look around and while inflation is abating to a degree, right? You know, that's great. We're all thinking disinflation to a point, although it's been kicked up. The Fed is in a very difficult position right now as to where we are economically, where we are from an inflation standpoint, and then to cap it off that we're in an election year. So kind of, can you speak on that?
Well, I would argue the opposite, that the Fed is actually in a great position right now because they've basically stumbled in to the position they're in where now rates are really high and they can start lowering rates at any time and it'll help support the economy. So they have this sort of like bid under the stock market and in the bond market now where they're basically saying we're not going to raise rates. You know, there's no reason for them to raise rates, but we're going to lower rates. We just don't know when. And essentially, so part of the problem that investors are having right now is the fact that many people have only been doing this for 10 or 20 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm actually hitting my 30th anniversary, but my track record of doing this goes back, I would say 40 years. So when I was about 13, I started investing. You know, so inflation is a byproduct of growth and a growth in wages in a lot of cases. And that's good inflation. And then there's bad inflation where the government's just printing too much money, which makes goods go up in price without any added value. Mm-hmm. You see? And what happened during the pandemic was the government essentially, you know, did a lot of the wrong thing, including, you know, printing trillions of extra dollars that ended up not being needed. And in the process of doing that, what happened was is that the Fed really put themselves in a bad position because as the government continued to print money, the Fed was like, oh, no, now there's inflation. We got to jack up rates in 22 so fast and so high to offset the fact that the government continues to print so much money. So inflation is real. It's just, it's a real thing because the government refuses to stop printing so much money. And that inflation is what we have to worry about, which is really deficit spending. And so when you actually look at the real economy, like you and I going out to dinner, rent, you know, how much we pay for fuel, if anything, everybody has a different inflation rate in real life. So lower income people have a much higher inflation rate than wealthy people, for example. Mm-hmm. And so the way inflation affects people varies in the economy. So at the same respect where lower income people are seeing the greatest wage growth that they've ever seen, they're also being offset by the problem of higher costs that really do affect them. But if you're a homeowner who drives an electric vehicle, for example, and lives in Santa Monica, you don't really see a lot of inflation unless you're going out and buying $22 bottle, you know, glasses of wine. I was going to say bottle of wine.
Yeah,
now it's a glass of wine.
What's that? Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot of services inflation for entertainment, for example. If you want to go to the Sphere and see Dead & Company, it costs thousands of dollars.
Unbelievable.
But if you're living, those are choices you're making. So if you're living your life from the perspective of like the commodities that I need just to live and survive, inflation has moderated substantially. And there's many ways people can mitigate their cost of living too. So that said, the biggest issue we have is the government continuing to print tons of money, huge deficits, huge amounts of debts. And now at 5% interest rate, this is sucking all the money out of the government in interest payments as well. So this is my biggest concern. But the actual real inflation now is mostly being driven by higher wages. And that is actually not bad news if you have a good economy, which is what we have. So the world has to get used to inflation averaging between 2 and 3% versus, you know, a world where it was like anemic between 0 and 2 and the Fed was just like throwing money at every issue they had.
But at the same time, Ross, if we go, let's just say 2 for the heck of it, okay? 2% inflation moving forward, prices are enormously higher. Like, I think McDonald's came out the other day. They were really concerned about all this commentary about the incredible inflation and the cost factors with their, you know, all the $18 Big Mac or in one place and all that. They said, no, we've only seen 40% inflation since 2019. I'm thinking, wait, only 40% inflation? That's what this guy's leading with? I mean, it seems a little bit difficult for those people. We didn't see 40% increase in wages, have we?
Well, once again, the real wage growth in the United States is very low, and it has been for, it's been negative actually for a long time until recently. So the as I said, the McDonald's issue is a real issue. McDonald's workers in California now get paid $20 an hour. So in one sense, flipping burgers makes you 40 grand a year, which is really nice. So if you're trying to hire, you know, there's a headline that hiring a nanny for the wealthy in Palm Beach is something 110 like to 150. 150.
Yeah,
which seems absurd. But actually here in LA, it's about half that, let's say. And so like when you actually think about it, you know, like the average lower income person is making substantially more money than before the pandemic. Okay. So with that came, then McDonald's raises prices, right?
Yeah.
Like, because I got to pay these people and I got to make my margin. So McDonald's makes a very high margin. I don't know if you've ever looked at McDonald's stock, but McDonald's makes very high margins on their food. So whether people realize it or not, McDonald's is a highly profitable business and they're going to maintain their margins if they have to pay people more, or they're going to hire less people, but they're not going to change their margins. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so inflation or real wage growth has been way low. And that's why there's so much dissatisfaction with the Biden economy. Because what Biden figured out how to do, which is actually quite amazing, which is have wonderful growth and yet have nobody gain real wealth. You understand what I'm saying here?
Mm-hmm.
We have wonderful growth, but nobody's gaining real wealth because of inflation. Right. And so unless your income's going up 10% a year, right, which is like only union workers that Biden has gotten on his side, you know, or getting those big raises, but everybody else is still looking at 3 or 4, 5% raises, and that's barely keeping up with inflation, and that's the issue.
But, you know, if we're going into an election year, and I don't mean to go down this whole rabbit hole here, but we got two elder statesmen, just to say it politely, okay, old coots that potentially could take the office at this point, and even with the recent, announcement of conviction, blah, 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 with Trump. Fact is that it looks like he's still, no matter what, he's going to be on the ballot. Both these guys have different ways of spending, right? One has lower taxes. It's not spending, but lower taxes and hopefully grow the economy. The other one is just let's give all sorts of money away through variety of different stimulus and just direct payments. I don't know which is worse. Both of them, though, the point is we'll have either higher spending or less receipts. So as a country, how do we look?
I mean,
I'm talking about just the country. I'm not talking about the individual and companies and all that. Company, you know, if we were
as a country, our finances suck.
I mean, would you buy our country from a
yeah, I buy our asset? Country because we have the best weapons and nobody's going to stop us.
Okay, I'll give you that. All right, I'll give you that.
So, you know, the advantage we have is everybody has to deal with us. So Russia and China are weak countries right now. They're failing like whatever system you want to call them. I want to say communists, but they're not communists. It's really dictatorships.
Mm-hmm.
So China and Russia are failing dictatorships right now. I don't care how much posturing China can do. They're failing. Their whole economy's collapsed and essentially now just being bought up by the government to support prices. And the Chinese people aren't going to deal with this for much longer because they thought they were going to be the richest people in the world. And they're actually now not even close.
Yep.
And so Russia, which is just a failed state and now has lost all of their assets in this war, you know, so America's definitely in the best place we've ever been, actually, in a lot of ways, if you look at power. On the other side of the coin, we're not acting smart with this power, and we're just spending our profits, essentially, on nonsense. And so, obviously, tax cuts makes no sense. You can't cut taxes. You know, we have huge deficits into the sky. So then you have to look at spending less money, which is the only solution. The only solution is the government has to wake up and say the most we're going to spend is 3% more than what we take in. And that will keep inflation at 3% or less. And the easiest way to do that is say this is the most we're going to spend and everything else has to be cut. And every year there's this like talk of this stuff. And then, it doesn't matter what party you're in. They all lie and they don't do any of it, you know? And so we have the dumbest government. The people who work in our government are so dumb. It's never been this dumb. And there used to be like some element of like, we just have to survive as a nation. So some very competent people used to run for stuff. But the bottom line is today they don't. Today, the competent people go into business or medicine or science or engineering. But nobody's saying, I can't wait to be a politician. So we have the least competent people, the people who are most able to raise money, essentially, from corporate donors who will represent them. But they certainly don't represent the people.
I hear you. Let's switch gears here and let's talk about the markets. Market-weighted indices, representation. I don't know how you stand on this, but you know, we're seeing right now the big run-up in, you know, the names, right? Oh, just pick whatever name you want. But the run up at the top, yeah, NVIDIA, top 10 guys, and it's really just dominating the market cap weighted, whether it's the Qs or whether it's the S&P 500, even the Russells, different for the Dow Jones, of course. But is that something that you think will ever change, the market cap weighting, or is it kind of designed just to keep the perpetual momentum going?
You know, I was having this whole thought process this week about markets, because one of the things I come to terms with is the foolishness of this active versus passive debate. Okay.
Okay.
The market is broken right now. And the way it works is that money has been leaving, let's say, mutual fund managers and asset managers who pick stocks and try to allocate capital based off what they perceive as the best companies, to passive indexing, which is essentially market cap weighted based off who performs the best, gets the bigger weighting, and then therefore gets more buys because they're a bigger weighting in the index. So nobody can beat the index because all people do is buy the index. So think about if trillions of dollars have left mutual funds and trillions of dollars are going into the index, essentially you have brainless people choosing 500 stocks. And then however they perform is how they perform. Mm-hmm. And so the problem with this system is that it just keeps buying the same stocks every week. Mm-hmm. And if you're added to the S&P 500, that's a gift, you know, mm-hmm. and then the gift just keeps on giving. And so the Mag 7, as we call them, who are the dominant companies in the S&P and in the United States, will continue to have high valuations and go up forever as long as people buy into this concept of indexing. So at my firm, we do both. We buy the S&P and then we buy our stocks, like in my fund GK, and we put it on top of the S&P. Because if you don't own the S&P, you're almost stupid, because that's all people buy and it has to go up based off that theory.
Right.
And if you're trying to be a stock picker like me, it's extremely difficult to pick small and mid-cap stocks and beat the S&P because there's no money going into small and mid-cap stocks.
Right.
Nobody has a brain anymore and says, oh, you know what? Small caps could grow to be big caps. That's not how it works anymore.
Well, they're lazy.
Buy the 500.
They're lazy. Nobody wants to do the work. Let's be honest.
Buy the 500. We keep doing this and we keep doing this. We all keep making money. So it's almost like a weird, it's not a Ponzi scheme, but it's like a weird system of if S&P likes you, you gain lots of wealth. And if S&P doesn't like you or whatever, or I don't know, you know, it's like you can't go up. So
I think the
Russell 2000 next to the S&P, it's like you can't make money. The average PE of non-S&P stocks is substantially lower.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because you get this perpetual motion, as you mentioned, you know, this whole thing. And, you know, if people can't beat it, why not just get involved in it? And I get that. I totally get that whole thing and what's happening.
It's a self-reinforcing cycle.
Exactly.
That's all it is.
That's exactly the point. That's exactly my point. It's like we buy, well, what happens? It goes up. We buy more. Now, once that day comes, if that day comes that there's going to be a bit of a correction, it's that much more difficult for certain. It could be that much more difficult for some of the big boys like we saw in 2022. You know, it just they got ripped.
Another thing's happening, Andrew, and this is a big secular change in markets. And what's really happening is young, innovative companies like mine are getting investments from private equity firms instead of going public. Mm-hmm. And in the old days, in the 90s, when I started, everybody went public. You didn't even have to make money. You could go public. You wanted to go public. Right. You had access to capital. The regulation wasn't crazy back then, you know? Mm-hmm. And there were tons of stocks you could choose from that were like 100 million to a billion. You know, And so there was like an opportunity for like the Peter Lynch's of the world to go out and pick lots of small and mid-cap stocks. And nobody bought the S&P 500 back then, you know. Mm-hmm. And so like there was this like real market of stocks. But today, essentially, all people do is buy the S&P 500. And those are the only stocks in the stock market. And what's happened is this thing called private equity or private credit, which is now the new stock market, which is basically if you're rich and you have good connections, you can get access to all these kind of companies like mine, but we're not going public because who wants to deal with it?
Yeah.
You know? So the best opportunities now aren't necessarily making it to the stock market until they've been played out. And so
until they've been wrung out by the private
equity. Right. After they've been successful and the private equity guys want to get out.
Yeah. It's an exit strategy.
So you're buying.
Right. It's the old exit strategy used to be going public. The new exit strategy, let's go private equity to a degree. Private equity, they'll wring everything out of it and then just, you know, push it on and then rug pull it.
Because the private equity guys come in and the first thing they say is we're going to be out in 10 years. And so that's your plan. It's a 10-year plan.
Mm-hmm.
And so like if your 10-year plan is to go 5X, 10X, that's their goal. But then how do they get their money back? There's only two ways. One is selling to another private equity firm or going public.
Right.
And so what's happening is you would much rather invest in my company today when the private equity guys are doing it than in 10 years when we cash out. Not to say it won't be great in 10 years for the next 10 years, but, you know, a lot of wealth can be gained. And so what investors are doing is they're looking for more private credit, private equity, more opportunities that are outside the stock market that have double-digit rates of return potential that you just can't find. And let you know, the S&P is going to do 10, 11% a year for the rest of eternity. But if you want to make 15%, it's really hard if you're picking stocks because essentially you're getting stuff that's already played out, you know?
Private equity usually does a lot of leverage or does some leverage that's benefiting obviously, because if they figure, listen, we can make 10, I'm just picking a number. If we can make 9% on this investment, well, let's just double in on the leverage side of it. Then we can make, you know, a 17. But my point is they used to have a much lower rate that they can get. And what's happening now? Is it more of cash, less leverage?
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
You know, I'm actually a big fan of the fact that money costs money now. I didn't like, even though it was really profitable for me over the last 20 years, the free money thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like that kind of economy. I don't think the government should have to support the economy. And so this economy where money costs money is great. Now, it sucks if you're in commercial real estate and you got all these loans, because they're all looking at 4% loans and 3% loans that are going to mature at 6.5%. So real estate's a horrible place to invest right now. Just a nightmare.
Yep.
I would not touch anything but residential home ownership, which is, you know, home builders, you know, but other than that, you know, commercial real estate is
formerly heavily leveraged commercial REITs that have to refinance on top of it. A lot of this stuff are really troubling.
They're really troubled. And then you look at the same idea with private equity and with hedge funds that use tremendous levels of borrowing at, let's say, 3 and 4% in the past to then invest in, let's say, the S&P and earn 10%. So exactly what you're saying, if I earn 10% and I leverage it up, I could really earn 15 to 18%, you know, without actually working, just because my interest rate was, let's say, 3 or 4%.
Right.
But if it's 7 or 8% or 10%,
whole different animal.
That doesn't work.
Exactly.
And so we're seeing actually a deleveraging among many companies that use debt to increase returns now are like basically just using their cash to pay off those debts because they're going out to the market looking at 6.5, 7.5, 8.5. And none of that math works when their return on equity is 10%, you know?
Let's talk about some of the stocks that are out there. I don't know if I got to, you know, it's Ross Gerber. We got to talk about Tesla, for God's sakes. So Ross, you know, I'll tell you a story. When I first either met you or know of you, it was always, I was like, oh, man, that guy's like a fanboy of Elon. He's just, seriously, I mean, I'm being honest, right?
I mean, I was a fan.
Yeah, you fanboy and all that. And then something happened the last, I don't know how long it was. I'm like, Ross has really moderated that dramatically. And actually, there's been a lot of criticism that you've given. And I was like, at first, I'm like, what is Ross doing? You know, he's dissing his best friend. But seriously, I mean, what's your take? We can talk about Tesla and EVs and Elon at the same time, because there's three different discussions there, right? EVs have gone a little bit kind of like, everybody's like, oh, EVs are great, but what about hybrids? That's kind of a thing.
Right.
There's Elon the man, right? The guy that's just all over the place with, you know, now great. How great of an idea was it to give 15 people, shareholders, that vote in the way of favor of his salary package, $56 billion, tours of the gigafactories? I mean, that is something you don't see a CEO ever doing.
I mean, honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if Elon starts, you know, like carrying home people's groceries for votes at this point.
Right,
you know?
Right. But this is a deal that was agreed to. I don't know where you stand on this. I think it's an enormous amount of money. I think it was when it was put in, we were like, oh, come on. This isn't going to happen right back in the day. But that was voted on. Now, whether or not it was some of his cousins and people and stuff like that in the boardroom voting on it. But where do you sit on that?
So just to preface this, there's probably nobody in the world who knows more about Tesla than me.
Okay.
And I mean that as modestly as possible. But I've spent a decade with the company, with Elon, with its executives. I've been in the battery factories in Austin. I'm driving a Cybertruck right now. I know full self-driving better than anybody, what its capabilities are. And my job is as an investor. It's not as a cheerleader.
Mm-hmm.
Now, many people in my business are on TV a lot, are cheerleaders, and they're analysts, and they don't actually invest real money. I managed $2.8 billion, and at the high, our Tesla position was worth, let's say, about $125 million if you go back 2 years, let's say,
mm-hmm.
a year to 2 years. And really, the problem started with Twitter. So when he bought Twitter, I got involved with that. I don't know if that's good or bad. And I asked them, Jared Bushnell, and I said, you know, is Elon going to be running Twitter? Is he going to be like the arbitrator of free speech? Because this is probably the worst idea I've ever heard. And Jared was like, oh, you know, just temporarily. And, you know, he's just going to like turn the company around and then turn it over to new management and get back to Tesla. That was sort of the plan.
Mm-hmm.
What was not the plan is that he's totally addicted to the social media and attention. And, you know, it's put him over the deep end mm-hmm. of self-importance. And so what's happened is that he buys Twitter. He realizes it's a horrible idea and tries to pull out. If you recall, most people don't recall now, that Elon knew this was the dumbest thing he could be doing once he looked at it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I said at the time, I've been analyzing Twitter for years. I have friends at Twitter. I'm happy to help you guys understand what you're buying because I don't know why you're buying it because it's a piece of crap.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't want my advice because he was buying Twitter and it didn't matter what I said. So when he took over Twitter and he fired everybody, all my friends, everybody who worked there, and basically decided that he was going to be the arbitrator of free speech and the CEO, and then proceeded to make one mistake after the next, that's all fine as long as it doesn't hurt Tesla, right?
Mm-hmm.
So everything's plowing along other than he's just distracted, right? Mm-hmm. So he's a kid with his new toy, no biggie. Tesla peaks in end of 21. And at end of 21, we had earnings estimates out, you know, $4 for 22. It was trading at 100 times earnings, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that's where Tesla was at the high. And so Tesla starts going down because basically their earnings potential wasn't going to be that. And it turns out it isn't that.
Mm-hmm.
And Tesla hasn't earned $4 yet. Okay. So what's happened now is now Elon starts tweeting all kinds of garbage and people start calling me pissed off, you know, like clients and like investors.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, what's wrong? What's wrong? Oh, did you see what Elon said today? And I said, no, I was actually working today, you know? And they're like, yeah. Oh, go online and check it out. And then it's like, oh, you know, the great replacement theory he's backing today, you know? And then it became clear to me that Elon could be a white supremacist, and this could be a big problem for the company. That if he shares his political viewpoints and his viewpoints are racist, this could be a problem. Because in this day and age, there's very little, in real life, I think there's very little, how would I say, sympathy for racism or anti-Semitism or anti-gay behavior or whatever you want to call it. Now, you can call it woke mind virus or not. The way I look at it is this. For hundreds of years in America, many, many people have been oppressed by white people, whether you like it or not. Okay? It could be gay people. It could be women. It could be Jews. It could be Irish people. It, you know, the amount of racism in this country's history, it's there's just no doubt about it, right? Mm-hmm. So we've all tried really hard to fix these problems in our society. I do think Black people and women and Mexicans and whoever, we should all be treated equally in America.
Sure.
That's what I
sure.
believe. Yeah. Okay? So when you start sharing ideas or ideologies that conflict with that, you create a problem if you're selling products. Now, if you're a podcaster or a blogger, it helps you. So if I'm at Twitter and I'm trying to get engagement and I say obnoxious things and tons of people come to Twitter to look at it, well, that might help you at Twitter, but it certainly doesn't help you at Tesla. And it really started in November of last year when he made the anti-Semitic comments and then went to Auschwitz with his kids on his shoulders, acting like it's Disneyland. And my Jewish clients start calling and they say, sell all my Tesla stock and I will never drive this car again. And I'm like, oh God, we got a problem. Now, not that Jews are such big Tesla buyers. That's not the issue. The issue is that that's just one group.
That's the point. It's just one group. That's
and the next week is LGBT people. Then the next week he says Black people can't fly planes very well. That United... What was he saying? That DEI makes the airlines unsafe because Black pilots are probably not qualified. Now, I'm sitting here thinking this guy has no idea what it takes to become a pilot, number one, and how hard it would be for a Black person to become a pilot. That, in fact, the Black pilots in America are probably the best pilots in America. Because the standard that they had to go through is probably much harder, right? Because of racism. Now, Elon doesn't know that because he grew up in apartheid South Africa. He has no idea what it's like growing up in America as a Black person at all.
Yeah.
Okay. At all.
But the thing is, Scottie Scheffler,
a white guy, number one golfer in the world, is taken away to jail for nothing. Imagine if he was an African American guest.
Right.
You know?
Right. But the thing is that this
doesn't sell cars. That's
no, but this also started with that interview. There was a 60 Minutes interview, with that. Remember the long pause interview?
Yeah.
And then basically said, I don't give a crap. I just don't.
And then the go fuck yourself to those people. So basically, what he did was he had a campaign to piss off every group of people except right wing white people, and then Tesla sales starts going down. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's just. That's what happened.
Right.
The Tesla brand value starts going down. Mm-hmm. And then everybody's like, why do I want to drive a Tesla? Even though it's the best car on the road, it represents a racist. And that's basically what's happened now. So people buy Teslas because they're the best cars on the road still. Okay. They're amazing vehicles.
Yeah, sure.
But they're buying them because they're cheap and they're reluctantly buying them. And they're pretending that Elon's not involved. That's what's happening. And so Tesla's selling cars again, but they just have to give them away. And that's what they're doing. They're giving them away. So how does the stock go up when it's going to do $2.50 in earnings this year? It's trading at $175. Okay. And they're saying $3.20 next year. And I go, what's going to make it better next year? What's going to get more people to buy Teslas next year than this year? And this is why I got pissed off. And this is why I sold half my Tesla stock and all this kind of stuff is because I see Tesla having lots of challenges moving forward. Lots of challenge.
The whole Twitter thing was where I think everything went wrong. Obviously, as you mentioned,
100%.
It all of a sudden was culminating to that point. And I think he thought he can get away. This is my two cents, but could get away with whatever he wanted to say. And then he got stuck. He like got stuck. Like he was going to do this. It was going to be great. And then he's like, let's just raise those money.
No, listen. I'm on TV all the time. Okay.
Yeah.
I have really extreme opinions. Okay. Mm-hmm. what when I started, my mom in particular was like, this is scary. Like, there, you say lots of things that you could just get canceled. Remember, like, cancel culture, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And here I am trying to build my firm, and I'm on TV all the time, and everybody at my firm is scared crapless all the time. And I'm going to say the wrong thing. And I work very hard not to say the wrong thing. Now, I've said things that were even borderline offensive,
yeah.
you know? Mm-hmm. And people email me and people call me. And then, like, we have 8,000 plus clients. And then, like, a client will call their advisor and be like, I didn't like what Ross said about this or that, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's just, like, becomes ridiculous. So I basically can't say anything anymore without somebody saying something. You see what I'm saying?
Yep.
So I've taken the opposite tack. I'm in business. It doesn't serve my needs to share opinions about politics, for example.
Right.
Because it will just turn off certain customers of mine. Some customers will be super happy, but some will leave. And it's just not worth it because my politics and my belief system has nothing to do with managing money. You see what I'm saying?
No, I get it. Listen, this
is so like if you wanted to do a podcast of what my opinions really are, I would just change my name to, you know, Steve Johnson and wear some sort of mask. And I'm happy to do a podcast of my real belief system and people will fall on the floor because, you know, actually my beliefs aren't that extreme, but boy, if you want to hear my opinions of people like Trump and the people who back him, boy, there'd be a lot of people who.
Well, let's not get into that because I got to tell you something. Anytime that I bring up politics, even from like earlier,
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, even when I talked about earlier about like if Trump gets in or if Biden gets in, somehow both sides are going to twist that into a political discussion.
This is what I'm saying.
There's no benefit. Yeah, there's no benefit. I'm trying to help you out financially. That's it. Let's talk about AI. Right. So let's kind of switch over to AI. So by the way,
right? It's like how fast can we move off that?
Yeah,
topic?
But the other, let's scratch that. No, but it's interesting. A lot of people don't know this. Back to Musk for a second. By the way, brilliant guy. Let's just get that straight.
Yeah, I mean, unbelievable. He's a brilliant engineer. I wouldn't say brilliant guy.
He's like from the future. Let's also say that.
He's a brilliant engineer.
Yeah. He also was one of the original investors in OpenAI. I don't think a lot of people know that. And then I don't know, why did he give that up, by the way? What was that about?
Well, he was kicked out.
Oh, well, there you go.
Elon's been kicked out of every group he's ever been a part of. He is not a group player.
Right.
You know, same thing at PayPal.
Right.
You know, almost same thing at Tesla early on. And then he kicked them out and kept Tesla. But he didn't start Tesla. He bought Tesla and then kicked these guys out and built it. Elon's never had a positive business relationship.
I can't see any disagreement with that from what I can see. AI. So he puts in some money, starts up this stuff years ago. Then it's taken off. Altman comes in, gets the whole thing rocking. We have AI somewhere along the line in, I don't know, was it 23? Really into 24, but all of a sudden everybody's like really jazzed up about
because of chat.
You know, nobody knows exactly what it could do. Nobody understands a lot about it, but it's like, oh, this.
Well,
is
I use it every day.
No, but in the beginning, I'm talking about like in the beginning.
Yeah, at the beginning,
everybody got really excited about it. Then Microsoft comes out with their. Do you remember Clippy? It's Clippy. Remember Clippy?
Yeah, Clippy.
That's what Clippy.
That was like a week.
That was Copilot. What Copilot is, right? The little dog.
The same idea. It's same like Siri, idea.
Right?
Alexa.
And how is Siri not AI? That's another discussion. But
Siri is like the worst program Apple ever built.
I get it, but it gives a lot of the early stages of AI, early stages of AI. Where
no, you know, Siri uses no AI abilities at all. In fact,
I'm talking about the early stage. You don't think the early stage of the building of it of the
no. In fact, I would argue the opposite.
Why?
Because this all came from autonomous driving and video games, not from Siri. Okay, so all this technology came from autonomous driving and video games from NVIDIA and people like Tesla and Elon. And this all started with GPUs, which were running graphics for video games, which then they realized was super good for autonomous driving because it could analyze the video from the cameras from the cars. Mm-hmm. In 2016, when we bought a ton of NVIDIA stock at $14, which is making me and my clients really happy right now. Mm-hmm. It was because we saw the CES presentation on autonomous driving with NVIDIA and Tesla. And Tesla used NVIDIA chips from the beginning. That's why Tesla's buying all NVIDIA chips now. It was always built on that architecture. So Elon was definitely one of the first people involved with AI because he was building autonomous driving systems. But that's where it came from. And the original genesis of it was from the GPUs really that were building, like the crypto guys were using them for crypto calculations.
Sure. Yep.
And it all started from gaming. Okay, so really the evolution of cryptocurrency and AI is ultimately goes back to gaming, which is why I've made so much money, because I'm a gamer and I've been investing in gaming forever. And I saw all this into autonomous driving and the Tesla. And you know, I can tell you all the problems now and all the challenges, which a lot of people don't understand, which now these people think they're going to solve lots of very difficult things that humans do very easily. And that's not true, it turns out. But that said, I think that things like Siri and Alexa were just simple programmatic programs that said, if the person asked this, then you query the answer from them. It was not about thinking or computer intelligence, as we might call it. It was really just about, you know, stimulus response.
So where does this go, though? Where does this go from here? Now, first of all, let's also say that everybody is AI something now, right? Campbell Soup magically has something AI. Everybody has something. It could be from the supply chain logistics. It could be from, you know, companies doing, for example, maybe biotech saying, you know what, we're going to do some of the trials on silicone, right, versus the human trials, or even the, not the trials, but the R&D, their data.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but where do we go from here? I mean, not everybody's going to come out of this play. I mean, NVIDIA's got a big arm, you know, leg into it. You got ARM, you got pick all the chip companies that could have benefits. But where do we actually go? What's your vision, Ross, some years down the road of what AI really is and what it is and what it isn't?
I just gave this speech to my investment team.
Oh, okay. There you go. I didn't know that.
When you look at transformative technologies, I tend to do these really deep, long-term dives into my thought processes. So let's go back to the industrial era. You know, we invented the steam engine or the engine. And for 25 to 50 years, you know, America changed from 1875 to 1925, this massive change from an agrarian, you know, like we farmed and tried to survive, to all of a sudden we had vehicles and trains and cars and going all over the nation. We took over our whole country, you know, during the 1800s. It was massive growth in America, you know, a really kind of violent and difficult history, but one of expansionism that was really predicated by this one invention. And then the next great wave in my mind was predicated around computing. First, you could say the computer chip in 1971 was really, you know, probably one of the greatest inventions of our time, which led to the internet, which is my era, our era, which started in the late 80s, early 90s, really, with AOL, which was one of my first investments. And the internet was as transformative as the steam engine. And in my mind, it has finally played out. In other words, anything and everything now works on the internet. And the internet's super fast, good. I was just talking about this. You can watch four screens with 4K all in your house, right? Streamed over Wi-Fi while your kids are playing Roblox.
Sure.
Like the power of the internet is maxed. Yeah. You know, like it can do everything now. So now it's like, what do I do with the internet? Oh, I got Netflix. Oh, I got all these winners, right? So now take AI. AI is as transformative as the internet or the steam engine. And you're going to say, oh, more hype, more hype. No, it's not. And let me tell you why. Because all of us are using basically old devices, old phones, old computers, old laptops. And why? Because they got so good at building them, we just don't need to replace them very often. Kind of what's happening with Teslas. Teslas are such good cars. If you bought one 5 years ago, there's no need to buy another. They work perfectly well. The software updates, they, you know, my iPhone, I don't need a new iPhone. It's great. It works perfectly well. So you kind of get to this point where it's like, okay, no, I go onto my, you know, computer, I look at my Microsoft, I can pull up stuff on Google. You know, I have all these databases. I can go into Excel. I can analyze data. I can do all this stuff, right? But computers are essentially dumb. They don't actually do much except what you tell it to do. So with inference, which is a fancy word for asking it questions, what they figured out how to do was get computers to understand a language. Okay. English, for example.
Yep.
So programmers used to take English and then program in. You'd say, I want a program to do this. And the programmer was like a translator to the machine, right? Mm-hmm. Well, now they created what they call large language models. And this is the biggest innovation in AI to date, because full self-driving doesn't work yet. So large language models work very well. It turns out that languages are patterns, and the computer can learn patterns really well. So AI's real strength is around data and pattern recognition and solving complex equations like crypto. Mm-hmm. And so it's not really good at everything. It's actually really good at certain things, but not really good with creativity or intuition, for example, which are uniquely human traits. But it's really, really good with spreadsheets. So when you look at how will this transform businesses in America, well, most businesses have been collecting lots of data onto clouds for a long time, including mine. But how useful is this information? It's not very useful at all, because unless I build programs to query this information and figure out why or what patterns this information, you know, is telling me about my business, there used to be whole teams of people to analyze this. Well, now the computer can do this. Why? Because it's really good at massively large data sets and recognizing patterns within those data sets. And if you can talk to the computer and just tell it what you want, this is a huge efficiency. It's just a massive efficiency. And one of the great efficiencies I've gotten from AI is just simply rewriting the things that I write. I have to write a lot, and grammar and spell check and all this stuff. It's wonderful, but not great. And now all of a sudden I put these things in the AI and it writes really well.
Oh yeah.
And I can get it and I can tell it to write less formal or more formal, or, you know, make this funny or add data from the web. So this is great. Now, AI is still very new and it has to go to the web and query information and then come back to your device. And the problem with that is that you have privacy and time. It takes a lot of time for a lot of the searches in AI still, and its depth of knowledge is quite shallow, actually. Mm-hmm. And so over the next 5 years, there's going to be this massive upgrade cycle where everybody's going to buy new devices, new phones, new computers, new laptops that have a third chip. They're calling them like neural processing units. They have some fancy names for them, but they're basically GPUs. So instead of having a chipset that's a CPU, a GPU, and that's it, there'll be a CPU, an NPU, which is really another GPU that's specifically for inference or answering AI questions, and then the third GPU for your graphics. And by adding this extra layer of software and hardware, then you can ask your phone or computer questions using English, and it will tell you answers about your personal information that's on your devices without it having to go to the internet. And that's a crucial level of safety and privacy that's going to be necessary for the success of AI. So the hardware upgrade cycle that we're about to begin will take at least 5 to 10 years. I mean, at least. And we're just like beginning. So this is a massive transformative theme that will take many, many years to play out. And buying the AMDs and the NVIDIAs and the ASMLs and the various things that are in my fund GK that are all related, including software and cloud providers, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, this massive upgrade cycle will make everything much more efficient. And it's extremely efficient the way AI gathers information and tells you what's relevant versus search, which is, in my mind now, really inefficient way to get information.
So does Google get squashed by this in a way? I mean, when I say Google.
Well, at first I thought they would get squashed for sure.
Yeah.
So at first I was like, oh my God, sell all of them.
Well, that's because their stuff sucked to begin with. Bart comes back with bad answers all the time.
Well, and plus search is not a perfect science. It's really an ad platform, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So like Google wants search to be like effective, but they also want to sell ads. So it's like, you know, is it really the best thing? You know, I don't know. It's like, if you say like, what are the 10 best hotels in Florida? Like it'll take you to like besthotels.com or, you know, Expedia.com or, you know, like, and then you go on to these things, they all recommend different hotels, you know?
Yep. No, I get it.
So
I get
like, I got to pick a source. But if I go into chat and I say, you know, based off the fact that my wife and I love golfing and spas, and we want to go to South Florida, but we will only stay at a 5-star hotel. What do you recommend?
Right.
Now, all of a sudden, it just tells you answers.
Right. Right.
And please give me a summary of each hotel.
Right.
Okay. So I thought Google would get killed. And then I realized, I go, no, no, no. Google knows everything.
Exactly.
So if I actually want good AI, don't I want good data? Because this is the problem with Elon's Gronk, is that he's using Twitter data. And Twitter data is garbage. And so he's building an AI system based around Twitter data that's garbage. And so it's so manipulated and it's so fake that essentially what it thinks the world really is, think about how twisted your brain would be.
That's kind of funny. Thinking about
Twitter was the world.
If I was to go and say to somebody, we have a school that is based on for education from K through 12, that is based on the Twitter database.
Right. History class is going to be based off tweets. Your math class will be based off tweets. Right. Philosophy. Probably be a pretty good philosophy class. But other than you'd learn about like white supremacy, and you'd learn about Me Too, and you'd learn about
how drinking chlorine could help out, clean out my insides.
All the different cures for COVID and misinformation and it's like if you spend too much time on the YouTube algorithm and you just let it take you places, next thing you know, you're watching a video of why the moon isn't real or something like that.
Right.
So Google actually knows what's really happening on the internet and really knows you very well. And that's why I actually think they're in a better position than many of the other players, because they actually know everything.
Well, plus they also have the cloud, which can be used for, they essentially have the LLM already. Right. Built.
They do. What they don't have is they're behind.
Correct.
You know, right. And so they'll catch up. I have no doubt, because they have unlimited resource. But I think if they catch up with their data, they will build a very good LLM that will be extremely accurate, especially around like businesses, for example, because it just has Google Business and everybody's listed, and it's been gathering data on our websites and everything forever. So it's less. Like Meta's data, is Facebook the data I want for LLM? You know, it's like, I don't think so.
Hell no.
And so I actually think Google's in a very good place for AI.
Yeah, I hear you. Lots of information discussed there. I think I was going to talk about crypto for a second with you, because I know that one of the times you talk, I think like a couple times ago, you set up a crypto, if I'm not mistaken, a educational component.
No, we have a crypto operation.
Yeah. Well, how's that? What's going on there?
Well, I mean, it's similar to fighting World War I. So fortunately, we've survived, which was looking a little shaky for a minute because we were with Gemini. And, you know, Gemini's the Winklevosses. And I figured these guys, when we first started, it's funny, we interviewed with FTX and Gemini and Coinbase. And the FTX people were a joke. So I was like, no, thank you.
Yeah.
But, you know, Gemini, I like them. And they're solid firm. And they were trying to follow all the rules. So that's why I like them. And we never did Gemini Earn. We never lent our securities.
Mm-hmm.
So we avoided the real damage because I didn't believe in that. Thank God.
The whole thing was anytime somebody says guarantee 15%, that is the magic. That's the magic number, by the way. That's the Madoff number. 15% guaranteed out.
Stake your crypto. I mean, saying that, I was like, come on, dude. You're going to lose your money. So although people did get paid back because crypto rallied, you know, it's like so lucky. So the moral is Gemini is still standing. And so our clients didn't lose anything. And now we're all up on our crypto, which is great and a miracle. But now with the ETFs, most of our clients don't use the Bitcoin. So it's like, what's the point of setting up wallets and all this kind of stuff when they don't even use the Bitcoin, you know? So it's like we have an ETF now. So if you want Bitcoin, and by the way, you can buy an ETF.
This confirms my longstanding belief of what crypto is. And I'm just going to focus on Bitcoin and Ethereum. That's it, the two of those for a moment. I know they're different.
Yeah, that's
I know
all it's all we care about.
But here's the point. The point was, I never saw the whole store of value necessarily, and I never saw the alternative currency. I saw the speculative investment that could be used maybe as a hedge.
You haven't been stuck in a bad country with no money. Bitcoin does work in every country in the world now.
I understand that. That I do understand.
So in other countries, it's much more common than the United States. And in fact, I would argue the exact opposite. Look at what our government's doing with our money. Like, just because somebody thinks gold is somehow better than Bitcoin seems arbitrary to me.
It's very arbitrary. It's very arbitrary.
So to me, gold and Bitcoin are the same thing. There are things that you can't print more of. And so if I buy these rocks or digital rocks, whatever, they'll be worth more in time just because the dollar's worth less.
I get that. No, I get that. But I still think that if I was
that's
to
what it is.
My belief is a fine investment as an alternative. But I just never saw that a government, our major government, would switch over economically. It's almost impossible.
El Salvador has successfully done it.
They're in crap shape to begin with. And that didn't really work out great for them.
It has worked out for them.
I don't know. I mean, I've seen a lot of different discussions about how beneficial it's been.
Well, part of it is fake because they live off U.S. dollars as it is. Okay. So El Salvador doesn't make any money. They live off U.S. dollars.
Yep.
And so by switching dollars to Bitcoin, this is sort of moot for them because they don't really have their own currency.
Right.
You see?
Right. No, I get it.
But I think the idea that everybody in El Salvador is using Bitcoin to buy and sell things, I don't think that's happening. I don't think that's how it works. But I do think that for most people in the world, let's take Argentina, probably the worst finances of any modern, or not even modern, semi-modern country. But
the good news is every time they go bankrupt, we just give them more money, though.
Right. And now they got this weird guy who's, trying to do austerity. And, when you do austerity, it only works if you stick with it. And we'll see if he can. But the bottom line is, if I was Argentinian, I would have all my money in Bitcoin. Like, why would I not?
Well, especially if you don't have your dollar directly necessarily linked to your own economy, that's a regulator. If, like, for example, El Salvador, if they were using the dollar anyway and their economy was delinked from their own currency, I mean, it is a link of a currency. I get that. But that means that they're at the whim of the valuation of the dollar compared to what their current situation is versus allowing themselves to maneuver the dollar value to benefit their own situation, like Japan
does. They can't because we maneuver the dollar.
That's what I'm saying. That's where the problem came in. And that's why they could very successfully, or at least have that alternative as like, okay, that could work. I get that.
Yeah, but most countries have their own currencies simply so they can print it. You know what I mean?
Right. No, I get that.
Yeah. So it's like for El Salvador, it's actually forces them to be fiscally like solvent. Because if they have their own currency like Argentina, they just print and print and print.
Yeah. So are you going to the ETFs now versus the core holding?
Well, yeah. So I own a little of the ETFs because it's way easier than setting up a Bitcoin wallet
sure.
for each client, not to mention. And then secondly, if they're a younger person who gets Bitcoin, they're better off having it in a wallet. But if they're like most clients who just maybe they want some exposure to gold and Bitcoin, which is I think a good alternative asset class for a hedge against inflation. And I also do very much believe in the utility of Bitcoin on a global scale, because I actually think most central banks in most countries are horribly misrun.
Mismanaged, run terrible, terrible.
Yeah. So like there's a huge utility for Bitcoin based off that fundamental thesis that governments are essentially really, really poor stewards of capital. And so historically gold has always been that hedge, because like China's buying gold now instead of treasuries, and they're buying like tons of gold and they put it in some cellar. Like, I don't see how that's different than Bitcoin.
Yeah. Well, we'll hear more about this mid-July when Anthony Scaramucci is our guest, by the way.
Oh,
that's
there you go.
A lot of fun.
He's like the Bitcoin guy now.
He's the guy. Ross Gerber Kawasaki, all the information about how to get in touch with you is going to be over on the Disciplined Investor episode. What are we in? 781 or 871?
Wow.
871.
That's
so
good.
We'll have it there. Thanks so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks for having me back. I always enjoy the show and I wish you best of luck.
All right, man. Thanks.
Yeah.
And that's going to wrap it up for this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me. What a great discussion with Ross. Always fabulous having Ross on. We cover so much ground in so many different areas. And I'm glad we had that opportunity to do so today. Thanks so much for joining me again. And I'll see you again real soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.
Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.